In fellowship, and let's continue on here, dealing with verses 3 and 4, where Jonah gives us some details with respect to his prayer and what he was thinking. It's not just his prayer, but also what was going on in his head from the time he was ejected from the ship, cast overboard, until the time ultimately that he gets delivered. We'll see that in verse 10, the actual deliverance. And clearly this prayer was written after the fact. So this prayer is not to be understood as being written in the time between when Jonah was, it occurred then, but it was recorded after the fact. So verses 3 and 4, "For you had cast me into the deep, into the heart of the seas, and the current engulfed me. All your breakers and your billows passed over me. So I said, I have been expelled from your sight and will never again see your holy temple." Again, I want to change the translation there, and we're now down to the explanation as to why. And 33 is where we're ready to pick up here. Although it might appear that Jonah is expressing some hope that he will live to return again to worship in Jerusalem, even though he has been banished by God, such does not fit the immediate context. 34, in this section of Jonah's prayer, he is recounting his plight and expressing the thoughts that went through his head as he faced imminent death. So in my opinion, Jonah thinks he's going to die. He doesn't have any hope at this point. And I think they've missed the point here again by suggesting that he's going to return to the holy temple at some point. "Or I will look again towards your holy temple." So secondly, point 35, through this prayer, Jonah has used synonymous parallelism to express his thoughts. This would be the only example of antithetical parallelism in the prayer. And again, he doesn't know that God is going to answer the prayer. He doesn't find out about that until after the fact. Jonah very well thought that God had abandoned him. So even though Jonah might, quote, look toward God, there's no guarantee that God is going to do anything for him. 36, synonymous parallelism fits the context much better and would then be translated as a recognition that he did not think he would live to see the temple again. And 37, there is nothing in the first half of his prayer that reflects any kind of confidence that he would be delivered from death. In fact, Jonah makes it plain, and also bear in mind that he's thinking this, what's recorded here in these verses is what's going through his head while he's in the water. He hasn't even, at that point, prayed yet because he's still in the water. He hasn't even been swallowed by the fish as of yet, so he's certainly not in the belly of the fish. So it would appear that he didn't think he was going to ever see the temple again. So synonymous parallelism here, point 36, fits the context much better. And then is a recognition that he's not going to live through this. So 37, there is nothing in the first half of this prayer that reflects any kind of confidence that he would be delivered from death. In fact, Jonah makes it plain later in the chapter that he did not even begin to pray until sometime later when he was inside the fish. So 38, therefore, it is best to understand the last portion of this verse as a reflection of Jonah's recognition that his death was imminent. His phase two was over, and he would never see Jerusalem again. And 39, the holy temple is to be understood as a reference to Solomon's temple in Jerusalem, as per some of the passages that Jonah would have been familiar with. Psalm 79:1. Deals with this, and certainly this was written before the time of Jonah. Who is at this time, again, we're down into the period roughly. Again, we can't fix an exact date for Jonah, but somewhere between, say, 760 and 770 BC. It would be a good guess. Based on a number of factors, not the least of which, of course, are the Assyrian king list and a recognition of the Assyrian life itself. So Psalm 79:1, the nations have invaded your inheritance. They have defiled your holy temple. They have laid Jerusalem in ruins. So again, the idea that did Jonah think he was going to live through this? I don't think he did. I don't think he thought he was going to live through it at all. I think when he's in the water, he pretty much figures he's a dead man, and that the only thing that is going to change this, well, I don't think he thought anything was going to change it. I think he thought it was over. And the fact that God did change it for him, again, should have caused him to wake up and say, hey, look what God has done for me. Surely I can see that God is gracious and merciful, so I understand that he desires to be gracious and merciful to other people, but not Jonah. No, that's too much to hope. Well, verse 5 now, water encompassed me to the point of death. The great deep was about to engulf me. Weeds were wrapped around my head. Encompass me is literally the cal perfect for third common plural plus the first masculine singular suffix of aphaph, aphaph. Aphaph, five times this word means to surround or encompass, to encircle something. Waters is mayim, the normal word for waters, masculine plural noun. Waters is used almost exclusively in the plural. I can't remember if there's ever a place where it's used in the singular, but waters are, because it's a collective plural. I mean, we know that water is water, but the Hebrew thought was that, you know, each drop of water makes it a plural. So waters encompassed me or surrounded me as far as or to the point of, preposition ad, and that means exactly that, as far as or until, to the point of the soul. The common singular noun here, nephesh. And so they translated nephesh, essentially with the idea, they've translated here death, although the word is soul, because the idea here is the waters are overwhelming his soul, and that's going to result in death. So this is a bit of an interpretative translation here, but one that fits the context. The great deep was about to engulf me. The depths is tahom. T-E-H-O-M. The depths or deep places, that's exactly what that word means. Then you've got a poel imperfect, third masculine singular, savav here. The depths will surround me. The only thing here to note is that he's kind of taking you into the moment. When he says, the water encompassed me to the point of death, the great deep, and they've translated here with a recognition that it's an imperfect, was about to engulf me. Not that it had already, but that the death was imminent, but not right there yet. Was about to engulf me. Weeds is actually just the term suf, S-U-P-H, a general term for water plants of any kind. Normally, it's freshwater plants, but in this context, it would have to be understood as seaweed. Plants that are out there floating around in the water. Seaweed or weeds were wrapped around my head. The cal passive participle, weeds being wrapped around my head, literally, is kavash. C-H-A-B-H-A-S-H. Kavash means 33 times it's used to bind something to something else. It's used to putting on a helmet, you know, binding your helmet to your head. Of saddling a horse. So in this context, weeds were his helmet, as it were. They were wrapped around as far as or upon my head. Inseparable preposition, lamed here, plus the masculine singular noun of rosh. And this means R apostrophe O-S-H. My head or on my head is fine. That word rosh is used in a number of ways, but in this context, he's talking about his physical head, the top part of his body. I descended to the roots of the mountains. The earth with its bars was around me forever. But you have brought up my life from the pit, O Lord my God. To the roots or of the mountain, you've got the inseparable preposition here, lamed, plus the masculine plural noun construct of ketsev, Q-E-T-S-E-B-H. Five times this word is used only, an arrangement or a fixed measure. Here it's used for the bottoms or the base of the mountains. They've translated it by the term roots, although there is a different word for root. But the idea here is where the mountains sit. Of the mountains is a definite article plus the masculine plural noun of har. which means exactly that, mountains. The earth, with its bars, was around me. The earth is a definite article here, plus the word eretz, which is a normal word for earth, one of them. There's a number of words that are used for land. But typically, eretz means sort of the entire earth. The earth, its bars, it's a feminine singular noun, so when it talks about bars, it uses a feminine singular suffix of bariach.
B-E-R-I-Y-A-C-H.
Bars, this is used for bars that are used to support something, or alternately, bars that are used to restrain something, like behind bars. And that's what, how it's used in this sense of restraining him. The earth and its bars, with its bars around me, supply the to be verb again. There is not one in the Hebrew, and so it's generally supplied in the New American Standard. Ba'ad is the preposition, and that means around somebody or even behind them or around about them. B-A-A-D-H. Forever, literally to the ages, inseparable preposition lamed plus the word olam, which means exactly that, to the ages. It's used of indefinite amount of time, both past and future. So it can be, you know, it can be translated or understood in certain contexts as eternity past. In certain other contexts, it can be referring to eternity future. Here, essentially, he's using hyperbole to say that there's no escape. I'm done. That this is it. And then here we have his final recognition. But you have brought my life up from the pit, O Lord my God. Literally, the wow consecutive here with the hiphil imperfect of Allah, which means to cause to go up. This time the hiphil is caused it. To bring up from the pit is preposition min plus the feminine singular noun of shakath, actually, in this case. S-H-A-C-H-A-T-H. This world means pit. The word means pit, grave, or underworld. And again, he's speaking figuratively here. He's not really dead. He's close to death. That we have no problem with. But he hasn't really died. And clearly he hadn't died when he was inside the whale, or he couldn't have prayed. So this is before he got there, so he still has to be alive. The idea is that he was still alive. And you have brought out my lives from the pit. Lives, again, K is very often used in the plural as well. Because there are various aspects to life. We do not view life as just one static thing. There, you know, you have good times, bad times, happy, sad, up, down, all the factors that go into life. Yahweh, my Elohim. The proper name, Yahweh, of course, just the tetragrammaton, Y-H-W-H. And the proper name, Elohim. Yahweh, my Elohim, Lord, my God. Okay, point one, Jonah continues to recount the thoughts that were going through his head from the time the crew cast him overboard until the time when the fish swallowed him. Two, it seems most likely that once the crew had determined to throw Jonah into the sea, that they did not waste any time and cast him in completely clothed. Three, this is based on the fact that in their view, Jonah was a dead man anyway. They were not concerned about his ability to survive in the sea. As we saw when we looked at the sailors and their dilemma there, they didn't want to throw him overboard because they knew effectively if they did that, that this was a death sentence on Jonah. And they didn't want to be guilty of foisting death on someone that they thought could be an innocent man. We certainly know that they understood Jonah wasn't a criminal. A criminal element like this, you're fleeing justice, you've committed a murder or something. Well, that might be a lot easier for those sailors to have dealt with. But they didn't. They looked at Jonah and said, this man is a prophet of one of the gods. Now, whether they, obviously, I don't know that they ever accepted Jonah's God verbatim and all that. But maybe some of them believed, maybe some of them didn't. But certainly it planted the seeds for future thought. So they weren't concerned about when they cast him over, well, how should we do this to give him the best chance? They were, for all intents and purposes, signing a death warrant in their view, and so they wouldn't have been concerned about any of that. So four, this would mean that the clothing quickly became saturated with water and the ability to stay afloat was severely compromised, to say the least. And then given the fact that even if the seas had, quote, become calm And again, the sailors would have probably considered 3 or 4 foot seas to be calm. When you get out very far into the Gulf, that's relatively calm. And that's on the Gulf side. So, you know, if you were actually in an ocean, the Mediterranean there, which we know can get pretty tempestuous. So that would still be, you know, it would still be very difficult if you were in that situation. But from the sailor's perspective, they would have said, well, the sea calmed way down. The storm stopped, obviously, as we know. So 5, therefore, all the events of verses 3 through 6 likely occurred within a matter of minutes. And these thoughts may well have been all that Jonah had time to think about before being overwhelmed. One of the reasons I don't think all this recollection is very long is I don't think it took very long. I don't think he was out there floundering around for hours. I think it would have happened all fairly quickly. And Jonah would have found himself being dragged to the bottom pretty early on. 6, the sense of absolute helplessness that would have been mentally overwhelming, as he was now completely surrounded by water with seaweed encompassing his head. And we're not even told whether or not Jonah could swim. So now how do you feel if you're out there and you can't even swim? Now, we don't know if Jonah could swim. Maybe he could, maybe he couldn't. In either case, if he couldn't swim, his time of staying afloat would have been very, very short. Even if he could swim and stay afloat at some level, again, you're going to wear out very quickly in this situation. And that's going to be about it for you. So 8 or 7 here, the verb afaf, encompassed or surrounded, is used only 5 times in the Old Testament. And all are found in contexts of imminent death. 2 Samuel 22:5 is the first one. And in fact, to be honest with you, one of the things that I think is going on here is that you're going to see in some of these verses, as I've already pointed out even in the earlier part of this psalm, or quote psalm of his prayer, but throughout this you're going to see that these verses all ring very much to what he's saying. So my guess is, because he knew his Bible, that these were the thoughts that came into his head as he was facing this imminent destruction. See, he's an orthodox believer. He's got a fair amount of doctrine. He's not an idiot. And he's acting like an idiot, but that's very much different than being an idiot. He's got a fair amount of doctrine in the soul, and many of these passages ring almost verbatim from what people had earlier said. And all the things that are parallel in this chapter 2 of what Jonah says is taken almost word for word from earlier parts of the scripture with which he would have already been familiar. Because this one was written here during the time of David, circa 1010 to 970 BC. And so therefore, this is a couple hundred years old from Jonah's perspective. So he would have had plenty of time to have learned all this. Here in David, as he writes this psalm, when the day that the Lord delivered him, verse 1, from the hand of all his enemies and from the hand of Saul. Verse 5, for the waves of death encompassed me, and the torrents of destruction overwhelmed me. Well, that rings very much to what Jonah is saying in sound. Water encompassed me to the point of death. Here he calls it waves of death, rather than water. Also, it's used in Psalm 18:4. And bear in mind, of course, once again, too, that Jonah's Bible was smaller than ours. His Old Testament was smaller than ours. Well, certainly, he didn't have any of the New Testament, but his Old Testament was smaller than ours and would have only included things really probably up to the time of Solomon. Now you're down around 930 B.C., and how much of the divided monarchy issues had been recorded and inscripturated at that time would have been up for grabs, as the kingdom was split there after Solomon. He might have had other writings too, for what it's worth, in that his ministry probably overlapped Isaiah, Micah, Hosea, and Amos as well. So would he have been familiar with their writings? Possibly. Hard to say, but possibly. Because there would have been some overlap, it appears, chronologically. But certainly all these writings here that we quote are much from a much earlier time. Psalm 18:4. The cords of death encompassed me, and the torrents of godliness or ungodliness terrified me. The cords of Sheol surrounded me, the snares of death confronted me. In my distress I called upon the Lord, and I cried to my God for help. Does this sound very much like what we've got in Jonah? Yes, it does. Now, did Jonah even look at some of these passages and say, geez, these are prophetic of my situation? I don't know. He could have. He might have. But certainly we see that the language he uses was, this is, he takes language that's known to be language of imminent death. Psalm 40, 12. For evils beyond number have surrounded me. My iniquities have overtaken me so that I am not able to see. They are more numerous than the hairs of my head, and my heart has failed me. And the last one, Psalm 116:3. And in, even in that context there, Psalm 40, it might not have been as evident, but it is a prayer for deliverance from imminent death. Psalm 116:3. The cords of death encompassed me, and the terrors of Sheol came upon me. I found distress and sorrow. So point eight, that Jonah recognizes death as imminent is clear, as seen in the use of the prepositional phrase, ad nefesh, as far as my soul or life, which is translated, again, it's an interpretative translation, I understand that, but it does fit the context. This is why when people think they're going to study the Bible on their own, even if they know the languages, which most people don't, I mean, I recognize that, but they don't, they're not going to go out and learn Hebrew, Greek, and Aramaic just to study the Bible. Nor do they have to if they've got a pastor that'll do the job for them. They don't have to. They shouldn't. They shouldn't need to. But here you have to recognize that even if you know the language, you still have to be sensitive to context and understand what's going on. And people will ask, I see this regularly on my Greek and Hebrew list, what version can I get that's a literal translation right into the English from the Greek and Hebrew? There isn't one. We covered this under bibliology in our review of the basics, and there isn't one. And certain translations, dynamic equivalent translations, are good in certain cases, and literal translations, word-for-word translations, are best, and interpretative translations are best in some contexts. And so one has to be sensitive to that, and if you're not, you'll say, well, geez, they didn't do a very good job here because this word means soul. Well, I know it means soul. But as far as my soul means that his soul is being overwhelmed to the point where he thinks he's going to die. So it's very to the point of or to the brink of death, very much communicates what's there. So point nine, the phrase the great deep is a bit of poetic hyperbole, which is designed to focus the reader on the vast depths of the sea in which Jonah found himself. And again, what difference does it make how deep it is? You're out there in the middle of the ocean and you're overwhelmed. I mean, you can drown in 10 feet of water. It doesn't have to be miles deep for you to drown. 10 here, one may be inclined to exaggerate when he finds himself helpless, trapped underwater, unable to breathe, and being carried down to his watery grave. So I'll allow him this a bit of hyperbole here. No matter how deep it is, it's really irrelevant. 11, while the Mediterranean is not as vast or deep as some other oceans, when one is sinking to the bottom of a large body of salt water, it makes little difference if the bottom is 50 feet or 5 miles. I don't care how deep it is, really. And if you're going down and you're going down to your death and you're still conscious, I don't think you'll care how deep it is either. It won't matter. And so that's why, you know, and I understand people have a fascination with this. I mean, I've gone scuba diving a couple of times. I haven't been certified or anything, and I understand that. I don't see the need or what the big thrill is to dive down to life-threatening depths. I mean, what are you gaining by that? Oh, the potential for nitrogen bubbles, you know, if you don't ascend correctly. How many things can go wrong at 100 feet underwater? Oh, more than you can imagine. A lot more than you can imagine. That's why, you know, I'm happy to just dive down, you know, 10, 15 feet. If something goes wrong, boom, I'm to the surface and I'm fine. I don't have any problem. And you can go down to the Keys and some of these other places, and you can do that for, it's not cheap, probably at $100 for a day, but still, it's kind of cool to do once or twice and see, and it's interesting. But why do you need to go down 120 feet? I don't. Even if you can go down and see 120 feet, you know, assuming it's light enough, and in many places it is. So Sarasota is not a great place for scuba diving. That's why there isn't a lot of it here, because the water's not clear enough. So again, when one's sinking to the bottom, I mean, it doesn't matter how deep it is, really. If you're going down and you're dying, you won't care. 12, Jonah uses the same verb that he had used in verse 3 to describe the effects that the currents and tidal forces were having on him. 13, the Hebrew verb savav, to encircle or to surround or change direction, indicates that the forces working against him were dragging him further and further down into the depths. And 14, while it is not mentioned, the reality of watery descents is that they are dangerous enough. Even if one is properly prepared and has the necessary equipment, that Jonah does not. And 15, the realities of drowning include the following. A conscious victim will hold his or her breath and will try to access air, which often results in panic. Now, if you've ever been panicked, you know what panic is. And when you get panicked, it makes your situation worse. Why? Because at that time you begin to lose the ability to think calmly and rationally. Once fear sets in to that point, and anybody, as you get older, one of the things that happens from time to time, and I don't know, I think for me, I remember it happening even in my 40s, as you get older, you become more and more aware of your mortality. You become more and more aware of certain things that you didn't think about when you were younger. And you confront issues that you didn't care about when you were younger. Because at a certain level, one of the things that we see there, we saw in Ecclesiastes by Solomon, is why target this younger audience? Because they think they're invincible. They think they're immortal. They haven't seen the things he's seen. They haven't lived through the things he's lived through. They haven't thought about the things he's thought about. And one of the things that happens is as you get older, you begin to have more and more self-doubt. Because you recognize over the years, my God, I'm an idiot. And many times if God's delivered you from certain things, you can recognize you're only one mistake away, one fall away from a broken bone, one fall away from death. Anything could happen. The world is a very uncertain place. And so this can lead to essentially what we call panic attacks. And now this, if you're drowning, this isn't just a panic attack. This is probably a good time to panic. If there is one. I mean, not that there is one anytime, but I'm just saying. I can certainly understand this. So B, once a person panics, this often induces rapid body movements, which in turn uses up more oxygen in the bloodstream and reduces the time to unconsciousness. C, the victim can voluntarily hold his or her breath for some time, but the breathing reflex will increase until the victim will try to breathe even when submerged. D, if water enters the airways of a conscious victim, the victim will try to cough up the water or swallow it, thus inhaling more water involuntarily. E, upon water entering the airways, both conscious and unconscious victims experience laryngospasm, during which the larynx, or the vocal cords in the throat, constrict and seal the air tube, preventing the water from entering the lungs. This is a part of the great design of the body, that God designed it such, that if a person is drowning, the body will still try to save itself from getting water into the lungs. Because once you get water into the lungs, you're done. And so the body itself tries to save itself with a reflex. F, because of this laryngospasm, water enters the stomach in the initial phase of drowning, and very little water enters the lungs. G, unfortunately, this can interfere with water entering the lungs too. H, in most victims, the laryngospasm relaxes sometime after unconsciousness, and water can enter the lungs, causing a wet drowning. You'd think, well, is there any other kind? I, however, about 10 to 15% of victims maintain this seal until cardiac arrest. And this is called dry drowning. Interestingly enough, you're drowning, but not because of water in the lungs. But as no water enters the lungs, and you can find all this in Wikipedia, this is pretty much common knowledge. I usually try to put a footnote there anymore if I'm citing something that you can go check out. So again, the idea of panic coming in, we understand, as you, again, we don't know really how old Jonah was at this time. But this isn't just part of the natural panic of aging. I mean, he's got a real reason to panic. He's dying. He's got literally his time is to be measured in minutes. And it won't take long. So 16, in any case, one should understand the nature of the panic and the helplessness that Jonah was facing as he descended to his assumed death. There's no way at this point in his thinking that he's thinking anything other than I'm dead. This is it. God's finished with me. It's over. That's all. I'm going to die in this horrible way because of my own stupidity. But there's nothing in his prayer that indicates that he even thought it was because of his own stupidity. He still doesn't seem to be willing to acknowledge I brought myself into this condition. And in fact, assuming, you know, let's assume he had gotten his act together, which I don't think he has, but I know some people think he has by this point, but I don't. Even assuming he had, why go to all this? He's brought all this on himself. He's the one that told the sailors to cast him overboard. He didn't have to do that. He could have said, take me back to the land. I've got to go to Nineveh, blah, blah, blah. But no, he doesn't do that. He's still blowing off God at this point, even though he's facing imminent death. Well, now facing imminent death, guess what? He suddenly wants to call out to God. Well, everybody, again, when they face death, is going to want to call out, trust me. Whether or not God will listen, that's another issue. So 8:17, he is still conscious enough to recognize that some seaweed had wrapped itself around his head, which very likely added to his anxiety. And who knows, though? What if that seaweed wrapped around his head and trapped some air in there, and that was enough to just keep him alive for that other a few seconds? We don't know. It could have been a good thing or a bad thing. Obviously, if you're drowning and you think you're going down and you feel the stuff wrapped around your head, you're probably not happy about it. You're probably not thinking, oh, well, this could be good. No, I don't think you would be thinking that. But I thought about this, and I thought, well, you know, that might have been part of what God used to deliver him. I don't know. It doesn't say. It's speculation there, so we won't go any further with that. Just to say that if you had this, quote, helmet of seaweed suddenly around you, and I don't know if you've ever gone out there and gotten some seaweed in the Gulf, but it's pretty nasty stuff. I mean, if you pick it up and touch it, it's gross, and it's, you know, you don't want it. Well, 18, the first phrase in verse 6 indicates that Jonah's descent finally took him to the very bottom of the sea, the extremities of the mountains. 19, this is a poetic way of denoting the very depths of the sea, the place where the bases of the mountains extend upward to the visible peaks above the water. 20, the prophet is referring to the base of seamounts or undersea canyons, which are abundant in the Mediterranean Sea. For example, the Hellenic Trench off the coast of Greece. I don't think they were up towards Greece, by the way, but we don't know exactly what route they took. Eratosthenes, seamount south of the Cyprus, the Nile, Fan, etc. The Hellenic Trench is 3 miles deep in some places. Other areas of interest include the Gulf of Sirte and the Libyan Head, which are both known for the seagrass meadows, i.e. seaweed. And then some of the other seamounts extend above the surface to form islands. The volcanic islands, for instance, off of Italy, like Santorini. 21, and all that research was courtesy of Seamus, so and give credit to him. 21, the next phrase, which deals with the earth and its bars, is a figurative way of expressing the fact that Jonah was imprisoned in the depths, with the prison door shut behind him. This is how he views, I mean, it's a poetic way of saying, God's put me into prison and locked the door. 22, thus, in his opinion, there is no possibility of escape or parole, which is further strengthened by the use of the Hebrew term la'olam, which literally means, again, to the ages or forever. So 23, at this point, although amazingly still conscious, that's what astonishes me, is how long he remained conscious in this, even as he's sinking, that somehow he remains conscious. So that's why I think this had to happen in a matter of minutes. This couldn't have been drawn out over hours by any stretch. The great sea creature must have swallowed him pretty early on. We don't know how long, but I don't see it being a long time, given the way he describes this. So, although conscious, Jonah has reached the conclusion that this is his fate. He will not live to see the light of day again. So 24, while it is not often mentioned by interpreters, the entire incident is miraculous. Again, that story I read you that you can find on the internet, which is not true, but you can read it. in order to justify this. But there's a lot of miracles in here, since Jonah astonishingly did not suffer physical harm. A, when one dives, the eardrums will rupture if the pressure is not equalized at intervals of about every 3 feet. And even having done scuba before, I know for a fact, one of the things they do, and if they're going to let you do this on a day basis where you don't have to be certified, is that they'll put you into about a 9 or 10 foot pool of water and let you dive to the bottom. Well, even in a 9 foot pool of water, you feel the pressure on the eardrum already developing. Just as you get higher, you know, when you go up in an airplane, you're flying, your eardrums kind of open up. Well, they'll rupture, they'll close down going the other direction. And the pressure, when you get to 20 feet, if you haven't equalized, literally when you get to 12 feet, if you haven't equalized properly, you're going to feel intense ear pain, the likes of which will make you scream bloody murder. Because I felt it, I know. And I went down the first time when I dove and I didn't equalize right, and I got down maybe 10 or 12 feet and my ears were killing me, and boom, I shot right back to the surface. Well, which immediately the pressure was gone. Once I was back to the surface, that pressure equalized and I was fine. But if Jonah's 50 or 100 feet down, his eardrum should have ruptured. That's a miracle right there in and of itself. Because I don't think he was equalizing as he went. I doubt that Jonah had studied deep sea diving. I'm pretty sure as a prophet in Israel, that wasn't a part of their curriculum. And so now there's no doubt to me that he wasn't equalizing. He didn't know how to do it. So it's a miracle God spared his ear. His eardrums would have ruptured. At 33 feet below the surface, the pressure on the body is double the amount of pressure on the body at the surface. And C, at greater depths, the incredible pressure is placed on the body, particularly any parts of the body that have oxygen in them. And D, at 33 feet below the surface. Now, that's not all that deep. He's talking about the base of the mountains. He's talking about going to incredible depths. Now, I don't know how deep he actually went. But even at 33 feet, which is not that deep when you're out in the ocean. I mean, you can go out here in the Gulf of Mexico, and I mean, it falls off very, very slowly when you're going out in the Gulf. It's like a big sandy desert out there, and it just falls off at a relatively slow pace. I mean, but you have to get out, in many cases, you have to get out 20 miles to get into 50 or 70 feet of water. So you would be at the bottom pretty quickly if you go out, even if you're just 5 miles offshore. You'd get to the bottom of the Gulf pretty quick. I mean, out here off of Sarasota, at any rate. There are other places in the Gulf where that's not true. You get up around the Panhandle and all that up in there, and it's way deeper, and it falls off way faster. Has different type of bottom as well, too. So at 33 feet below the surface, lung capacity is cut in half, limiting how much oxygen can even enter the lungs. And, of course, at 33 feet, you're not going to have any oxygen entering the lungs that I'm aware of. So 25, if God had not intervened, Jonah would have suffered ruptured eardrums, his lungs would have filled with water, and he would be dead very quickly. Again, the only thing that might have saved him was the laryngospasm that might have prevented his lungs from filling with water, but then they were going to fill his stomach with seawater. And of course, I don't know if you've ever tasted it. You've probably been out in the Gulf and have tasted the salt water. But if you can imagine inhaling fairly large quantities of it, it's not good. And on top of that, of course, it'll dehydrate you pretty darn fast, too. That's one of the real, you know, I see these people that one of the dangers is that they don't know. They get out there and they're trapped on the ocean and they're thirsty, 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 and they begin to drink the salt water. Well, they're going to die. It'll kill you. So, again, there are a bunch of miracles here, in my opinion, not just the fact that Jonah was swallowed by a fish and survived this. The very fact that he was alive to even survive is kind of a miracle. So 26, via omnipotence, God delivered Jonah from the forces that would have killed anyone else, overruling the natural laws of this world. 27, in Jonah's spiritual descent, of course, now as he's chosen to run from God, which has been accompanied by a number of physical descents that are parallel to that, he now ends up at the bottom of the ocean, unable to descend further. And 28, however, the latter portion of verse 6 indicates that God did indeed intervene. But again, Jonah acknowledges the fact that God protected him and ultimately delivered him from his watery grave. In 29, Jonah now shifts the perspective from the time of his amazing descent to the bottom of the sea to the present moment of writing, as he records the fact that he had been delivered. When he says this part at the end of verse 6, "But you have brought up my life from the pit," Well, that couldn't be acknowledged until after he's survived all this. So that's not, he's not thinking that on the way down or even while he's been swallowed by the fish. This is after he's back on land, is the only way he knows God has delivered him. 30, the Hebrew term shakath is used to refer to the pit, destruction, the grave, or the corruption that comes in the grave. It is not to be taken as referring to the depths of the ocean in this context. It is to be taken. That should be it is to be taken, not is not. It is to be taken as referring to the depths of the ocean. Psalm 39. Got an extra word in there, which kind of materially alters the sense of the sentence. Psalm 39, what profit is there in my blood? In other words, in my physical death, he's talking about here. If I go down to the pit, will the dust praise you? Will it declare your faithfulness? And Psalm 55, 23. These Psalms by David. Again, I think we're on. I think these were on Jonah's mind. I think this is the stuff flashing through his head. I mean, when you're really up to the point, I mean, you're talking minutes, seconds, maybe even away from death. What's going to be flashing through your mind? It's most likely going to be the doctrine that you know. It's most likely you're going to be thinking about God, and you're going to be thinking. I mean, because Jonah's a positive believer, as far as we know at this point. Just because this is a bad couple of months in his experience, I'm not going to write him off and just say he was a total idiot. But what's running through his mind very much reflects what we find in the scriptures, the thoughts that he was thinking. Psalm 55, 23. But you, O God, will bring them down to the pit of destruction. And Ezekiel 28:8, the last one here. And this is a prophecy to the earthly king of Tyre, often called the prince of Tyre, which extends down through verses 1 through 10. And then it launches into a psalm, a lamentation over the king of Tyre, which refers to Satan, the unseen ruler behind the physical ruler on earth. But this one refers to the physical ruler here, Ezekiel 28:8. They will bring you down to the pit. You will die the death of those who were slain in the heart of the seas. And of course, this guy was arrogant and manifested a bunch of satanic qualities. And because Satan wasn't literally the force behind him, then will you still say, I am a god, though you're a man and not a god. So 31, Jonah makes it plain that the agent of the causative verb to go up or to ascend is Yahweh Elohim, who caused me to come up, or we might even translate it, who brought me up from the pit, but just a recognition that the hifil of Allah there is causative, that the hifil root is the hifil stem is causative in that sense. And 32, this verse also demonstrates that God controls life and death. He can take life anytime. I mean, literally, you can walk out the door here and get stung by some critter, bit by a snake, or anything could befall you in quote, a relatively safe environment. And you could be killed in a car wreck on the way home. Nobody plans on dying today. I'm pretty sure of that. Anybody have that on their day planner? What time? Let me know. No, nobody ever plans on that. So even in the most benign of circumstances, one can die. I mean, there's always the inner organs failure, heart attack, any of that. I mean, that can happen. A brain aneurysm can kill you just in a second, that fast. And or on the alternate hand, and on the other side, you can be in the worst possible scenario with no chance of survival, and yet God can save you. And I don't know about you guys, but I tend to watch a lot of Discovery Channel and some of these things, and I see these people survive this incredible stuff. There's, you know, they even have a story, I don't watch them all, but I mean, I've seen them before, where they have this deal like, I shouldn't be alive. And, and they have these harrowing deals of people that did it, and in many cases did everything all wrong and survived. And then they have these other deals of people that were quite qualified, were well capable of handling things, and they died. And so how do we know the difference? Well, ultimately, by faith, we say God controls life and death. We don't. It's up to God. So again, he can sustain life. He can take life. He can give life. Genesis 6, 6 and 7. Genesis 6, 6 and 7 suggests that God can use natural calamity and catastrophe to destroy, if he wanted to, the entire human race. And there's every evidence from a study of Genesis and from the study of history that this was simply God's engineering of a natural, what we quote, natural catastrophe, was the flood. Genesis 6, 6 and 7, the Lord was sorry that he had made man on the earth, and he was grieved in his heart. Again, using anthropopathisms here to describe God, attributing to him emotions, so that we can understand that righteousness has now been violated to the point where God's justice must intervene in the under language of accommodation. And the Lord said, I will blot out man, whom I have created from the face of the land, from man to animals to creeping things to birds of the sky, for I am sorry that I have made them. Well, clearly, God's not sorry about the animals or the birds or the creeping things. I mean, this none of this moral evil that's on the planet is their fault. But yet, they're going to suffer by association in this evil. In the satanic and angelic infiltration of the human race, the demonic infiltration. And how did God do this? Well, it apparently there was some extraterrestrial planet, star, whatever. We don't know what it was. But something smacked into the earth. It did two things. Number one, it because of the incredible cold that this thing brought with it, and bear in mind that when you get out into space, you're talking on temperatures on the order of absolute zero. That you're talking an extremely cold place. And you're talking about something very cold. It could have been nothing more than a ball of cosmic ice. This hits the vapor canopy that surrounded the earth prior to the flood. It begins to, of course, immediately the first thing that happens is the vapor canopy starts to precipitate out. And so you have this immediate changes, great changes in pressure. Well, this thing slams into the earth, and it says the fountains of the great deep were burst open. Something busted them up. We're not told what it was. But the idea is this great thing came in. Started to vapor out. That's why it took 40 days and nights for the rain, because that's how long it took that canopy to vaporize out, to precipitate out. And then the fountains of the deep were burst open, and the earth apparently before the flood was about half, or different, opposite of the way it is now. Apparently there were two-thirds landmass and one-third oceans with a bunch of subterranean waters. And then when that happened, this was all reversed, and now you got one-third landmass roughly and two-thirds oceans. That are now the waters have been busted up and let out to the surface. And so that happens and destroys the entire human race. Wipes them all out, just except, as we know, for Jonah and his family. So so what happened when this thing hit? Well, because of the nature of the interaction of heat and cold, when it hit the planet, this thing is shattered into millions of pieces of ice that were apparently attracted to the magnetic poles. And that's why we still have, they know this, that much of this ice up there, they can't explain why it's so ancient. But they know it is. Well, God can use that and wipe out the whole human race if he wants to. Job 34, 14 and 15. So he has many things at his disposal. And then plus he can just flat out intervene anytime he feels like it, if he chooses to. This one talks about that. And he's talking about God, that he won't pervert justice, but that he has authority over the whole earth. If he should determine, verse 14, to do so. If he should gather to himself his spirit and his breath. All flesh, his spirit, is breath there is neshama, the spark of life. Whatever started you up when you came out of the womb and you drew in that first breath, that spark of life, that's what the neshama is. And that spark of life keeps you alive from then on. It's like a fuse that's lit and just keeps on burning. Until God just says, and one day, snuff it. He just puts out the spark of life and you're gone. And he could do that, as it says here, all flesh would perish together and all man would return to death. He literally could just take the spark of life from everybody all at once, just jerk it, and the whole human race would fall over dead, if he chose to. So he doesn't even have to use natural means. I mean, he has the power and the authority to do so. And 2 Corinthians 11, 25 through 27, here where Paul talks about his experiences. The things he went through. And Paul survived some very inhospitable environments, just as Jonah did. Jonah's, you know, probably the most notable example of this. But Paul's niche encompassed some of this as well. For I, verse 5, three times I was beaten with rods. Actually, it begins in verse 4. Now, the Jews only beat him with 39 lashes because very often on the 40th lash, people would die, so they kind of outlawed that. You couldn't beat him more than 39 times with the lash. Because you really shouldn't beat a guy to death when you're just trying to punish him. So that's the idea of why 39, if you ever wondered about that. Three times I was beaten with rods. Once I was stoned. He was stoned. Literally, there's a question as to whether or not Paul did not die at that stoning. That occurred in Acts, as we know. And they stoned him and dragged him out of the city, supposing him to be dead. And so did he die? Might have. I don't know. We're not told. Three times I was shipwrecked. A night and a day I have spent in the deep. And we have these stories, you know, for people to go out there and survive 24 or 48 hours is miraculous. And very often if they're out there that long, it's not too long much after that before they're giving up hope on them. Because they know you can't survive that long out there. Hypothermia sets in and all that. Again, you'd have a better chance this time of the year because the Gulf's a lot warmer. But you get out very far, and that water's a lot cooler. I mean, I've been out there. I've gone out, 30, 35 miles on a fishing trip, and it got real hot, and all of us decided to just get in the water. Well, it's way cooler out there than it is in here by the shore. And so you get out very far, and that's an issue because you don't have to lower your body temperature too much. I think maybe 3 or 4 degrees, and you're into trouble. And so even in 80-degree water, your body temperature is just going to start sapping the water temperature out of you. So a day and a night I've spent in the deep. I have been on frequent journeys in dangers from rivers, dangers from robbers. Now, how can a river kill you? Well, again, if you look, I've watched some of these survival shows. Some of these rivers are quite dangerous. I mean, many people die in rivers and floods, as we know. Dangers from robbers, dangers from my countrymen, the active conspiracies to kill Paul that we knew about, and some that we probably didn't know about but existed. Dangers in the city, dangers in the wilderness, dangers on the sea, dangers from among false brethren. I have been in labor and hardship through many sleepless nights, in hunger and thirst, often without food, in cold and exposure. And as you know, you can die very quickly in cold environments. Again, hypothermia sets in and you're done. You get tired and you want to lay down and go to sleep. And if you do that, you won't wake up. That's just a simple fact. So Paul survived in some very inhospitable environments, just as Jonah did. And other times, very hospitable environments. The flood, before the flood, the earth was, paradise. It was essentially a giant terrarium. There wasn't a whole lot of temperature variation. Everybody was more or less acclimated to the temperature. It was a wonderful place. As far as we know, men were vegetarians. There wasn't a lot of animals being killed or anything. There's no evidence that there was any. And so it was a pretty nice place. I mean, the vegans and the Greenpeace people would have loved it. And yet, even in that environment, God said, I'm going to kill the whole planet. I'm just taking them out. Because of the great evil. He didn't just do it arbitrarily. Okay, well, our time's up, so we will stop there and continue on here Wednesday evening. Thank you, Father, for this time together. We pray that you would sanctify this information to our souls. In Christ's name, amen.